Good evening, everyone. We are, I think this is our fourth installment. So tonight we're going to look at the Industrial Revolution, and we're going to focus on some topics that are Pesach related. And before we get into some of the related questions and topics that have come up, especially around this time in history, I wanted to go through a number of sources which give us a little bit of a background or a basis for what does Judaism think about innovation in general? What is Judaism's approach or worldview when it comes to technology, when it comes to advancement? The first individual recorded in the Torah to have invented something was a man by the name of Tuval Kain. You have that here in source number one. One of the descendants of the first humans to walk the earth. And it says that he sharpened all tools that cut copper and iron. And Rashi, on the right side, he points out that what he did, in a sense, is he refined the craft of Cain. And whereas in previous agricultural processes, whatever you want to call them, a person would have to use more primitive types of tools. He invented metal utensils or metal tools that could be part of the process of here, if you look in the bottom. I had the footnote there. This is from the Michta Meliyahu. He says, prior, people plowed the ground with sticks and rocks. Tuval Kain invented a metallic instrument. So our generation would have viewed the invention of Tuval Kain as an advancement in technology. If he would have done that today, that's what people would have said. However, and people would have said it's a replacement tool to, you know, to ease and improve farming. Chazal, that's what Rashi's quoting here on that right side, in source number one, explained that the Torah saw a destructive force behind this process. So it gives you a little bit of a window in. I'm going to show you one more example. A little bit of a window in to the tension between progress and tradition. And that's going to be one of the big themes of our discussion here. Progress is something that could be beneficial to society, but when the progress is being used for a type of activity which is illegal or threatening, or God forbid, a type of innovation that leads to destruction or devastation or death, then there's a little bit more of a caution that we would have toward these kinds of innovations.
It's not entirely wrong, because a lot of technology came from military needs.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's an interesting thing to look at in terms of some of the very well-known innovations that, you know, in medicine and other things that have saved lives have also been things that have taken lives. Another example is the story of the Tower of Babel, source number two. This, according to all historians and commentaries, was one of the greatest technological feats, architectural feats, maybe in all of history of mankind. The ability to build a tower of such a nature was really something to marvel at that time in history, with the kind of tools and knowledge that they had. Yet they built a really impressive structure. What were you going to say?
That's an engineering feat.
An engineering feat.
Not
okay.
Not necessarily
an architectural feat. So let's call it an engineering
He's
feat.
An engineer.
Okay. And Rabbi Shemshon Rafal Hirsch, in his commentary on the Torah, it's hard to make out exactly what he says here. It's on the right side. But his point is that technology should be a means to an end, not just an end in and of itself. That's, in a nutshell, what he means to say here. What ended up happening in this story is that was their downfall. The building itself was the downfall. It wasn't being used to further some kind of human progress. It was being used to, lots of different commentaries on this story, to challenge God, to make society all be in one way of thinking, all kinds of different commentaries. I think we actually spoke about it in the Parsha class back in the fall. So that's kind of one perspective. There's obviously a lot of other sources we could point to that speak about innovation and progress in the Torah. The other side of the coin is the sources that you see in the middle of the page, which are pretty well-known verses from the creation story, for example, where God says that our role in society, our role in this world, is to fill the earth and to subdue it, to rule over the fish of the sea, the bird of the sky. We have the idea of Tzelem Elohim, the image of God. The image of God, Reb Chaim of Volozhin writes in the Nefesh HaChaim, that's the middle passage, he says, it teaches us that man was fashioned to be a creator. God's role in history has been to create, and our role is to emulate God's ways, and our role is also to be a creator. And again, in Pirkei Avot, everything God created in his world, he created to express his glory. So we have these different ideas that seem to clash, seem to stand at odds, but what I think we understand from our own development and our own view of how Judaism reacts to innovation and reacts to progress in society and technology is that everything has to be looked at in its time according to our traditions and how things fit in. At the turn of the century, not the 21st century, the 20th century, the Chafetz Chaim, Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan HaKohen, who is the author of the Mishnah Brura, also wrote a book called Shmirat HaLashon, Chafetz Chaim, which is on the laws of how we use our speech, or how we shouldn't use our speech. And he also wrote a number of books, or his children and students wrote a number of books on philosophy and kind of musings, thinkings of what was going on at the time. So one of his books about called Shem Olam, he has a whole chapter on the innovations at the turn of the century, 20th century. And what he talks about here, I'm going to just read a few lines here. What he talks about in his introduction, and I have some of the English translation is on the right side, is that the generations spiritually have deteriorated as time has passed. And all of the technological innovations that we've seen in our time are coming to not correct these deteriorations, but to help us fill in the gaps where the deteriorations took place. For example, so let's look a little bit at some of the lines. I know it's small print, so I'll just read a little bit and translate. He says, "V'yadati gam yadati shikshu eza nashim hachachamim enem al devarenu, sha'adorot, all of the generations, kol mashu mukdam bizman hu mukdam b'chokhma." There's a belief, it's not... I think everyone in every generation is going to look at their children or their grandchildren and think that either they know less, they're educated less, or they're educated more in some ways. Maybe they know how to use technology better than the older generation, but they have less wisdom in other areas. But there's a general saying, and it's what was, I think, quoted a number of times throughout different places in Jewish text, Yiridat HaDorot, that the generations are diminishing in spiritual wealth or spiritual ability or spiritual strength. And he writes that we look in our generation, there's been a lot of innovation. There's been a lot of wisdom and progress that didn't take place for hundreds and hundreds of years. So how do we understand that? How do we explain that? And what he writes, and the four things he talks about are the telescope, the telephone, the camera, and the tape recorder. These were all innovations that were all around the time of the turn of the century. And what he does in his commentary is he goes through each one and he shows how each one filled a gap that was a spiritual void that had been lost over time. So for example, he talks about the telescope. The telescope was a great innovation. We have more access to places that we could never see before, to seeing the universe. And we're using nature, we're using the laws that were built into nature to be able to create such a thing. What's the message? What's the religious message? Because he views it as a ba'avonoteinu harabim. Because of our sins, because of our deterioration, we need such devices to remind us that if we could see so far, think about how much God is able to perceive and see. And he talks about the telephone. He says, for generations, Jews would pray. And when they would pray, they understood that they were talking to a God who they could not see, or who they could not hear communicating back to them. And that was just understood. That was the level of belief, the level of strength or emunah that they had in God. But as the generations deteriorated, they lost their ability to believe in a God that can't be seen or touched or felt. So why should I pray to such a God? So comes along the telephone and says, you want to hear something amazing? You can speak to someone who's really, really, really far away, and they can hear you on the other side. God can hear you too.
Does it reach the Shemayim?
Does it reach the
Shemayim? From your Shemayim, it's a local call.
Okay, a local call. And one more example. It's wireless, exactly. One more example that he has. He talks about a tape recorder. And it's so interesting to see how he in his writings, the way that he describes it today, we would kind of chuckle when we hear the way that he's talking about these innovations, which then were fantastic to people. Today we take for granted some of the types of technology that we have available. He says a tape recorder is a device that you can store a person's voice on. And that voice, it's amazing, he says, the voice remains there forever, even after the person leaves the world. And the person's gone from the world, and it's as if they're here. And you can hear their voice, and it's as if they're in the room. And he says, this idea of the voice being able to be intact, right, as if alive, think about God's storage space, that God hears everything, that God sees everything. So he's using these technologies as a message to our generation, as message of inspiration. So let's jump back a couple hundred years before the turn of the century, and we're going to look at two or three case studies of how innovation impacted the Jewish community in smaller and larger ways. So the first place we're going to look is actually earlier than the time of history we looked at last week, which is the invention of the printing press. Printing press, somewhat, they think, is dated around 1440. I'm not going to pronounce his name correctly. Johannes Gutenberg? Did I say it right? Johannes Gutenberg, actually, ironically, we spoke about this town a few weeks ago, Mainz, Germany. That was where the first printing press was invented. And it was an incredible, incredible change. In many ways, it marked some of the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, even though officially the Industrial Revolution was in Britain in the late 1700s, early 1800s. But in many ways, it set off in motion dramatic, dramatic changes in history, as we all know. So essentially how the printing press worked is you have these metal letters, movable type, assembled onto a page, and they had ink. The ink was made from different sources. And what they would do is they would color the ink onto the letters, turn the press over, put it on the page, put the letters, form the letters together, whatever words you wanted, and paper, which had also only been recently invented, that was put in the press. Oh, I actually have some pictures to show you this week. Let me pass these ones around. These are some depictions of the original printing press. And this is an amazing technology. So as you can imagine, actually, initially, Jews were not allowed to be part of the printing business. They were excluded from the ability to be part of this business. But eventually, when these printing presses made their way to Italy, Spain, Portugal, and others, Hebrew printing caught up. Each printer had to carve out his own letters. That's what we call fonts. And again, you're going to see differences between the way Ashkenaz books were printed, like Haggadot, for example. Haggadot were one of the first books to be printed by Jewish printers. Ashkenaz printers used more square letters, and Sephardic printers used more curved letters, which were going to be a reflection, basically, of how the scribes, the Sofrim, were working with their trade. One of the more famous early Jewish printers, very famous name we know today, Sansino. Okay? Sansino was one of the earliest and most important Hebrew printers. And 500 years later, they're still trucking. As we know, Sansino put out one of the first Talmuds. But that was not the Talmud that ended up becoming the famous Talmud. The famous Talmud was printed by a non-Jewish man, a Christian, wealthy Christian, by the name of Daniel Bomberg. Bomberg Talmud. That was in 1516. And he had a very accurate text. And also the Mikraot Gedolot, Chumash. It's also the Mikraot Gedolot that you'll find today in many synagogues and shuls and Batei Midrash was from that original printer. So after Sidurim, the second most printed Jewish text is the Haggadah Shel Pesach. Interesting anecdote. Actually, some of the early ones did have pictures in them. They had on display... Pardon? We're going to talk about it. It's coming. So the first case was a debate. It was a very interesting debate. Here's the case, the bottom, source number 4. A Rav by the name of Meir Ben Yitzhak Katzenellenbogens. Try to say that one 10 times fast. He was known as the Maharam Padua. And he was one of the great Geonim of his time, living in the 16th century. So seeking to take advantage of the newly invented printing press, he wanted to print a new edition of the Rambam's Yad HaChazakah, also known as the Mishnah Torah, the Code of Jewish Law of the Rambam, that would include, among other editions, his own notes. You can turn the page. Most of the major publishers at that time were Christians, as I mentioned before, who had served the Jews well with their publishing houses. Initially, the Maharam wanted the major publishing house of Mark Antonio Giustiani to put out his Rambam. Before a deal was finalized, the Maharam decided that another non-Jewish publishing house, that of Alvis Bragadini, offered a better deal. So he went to Alvis, and he was going to print with him. The first printer heard about the fact that he lost the business from this Maharam, and he decided he's going to go ahead and print the Rambam on his own. Not only is he going to print the Rambam on his own, but he's going to print the notes of the rabbi who asked him originally to print. And so the Maharam came to the Ramah. We all know the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, who writes the notes on the Shulchan Aruch, who gives us the Ashkenazic practice. He writes a lengthy responsa in which he deals with a number of the questions that were used to answer this question. And what's interesting about the case is he was basically deciding a case between two non-Jews. This was a case of which non-Jewish printer is he going to side with. One of the questions that he dealt with is the question of whether a non-Jew, which we understand non-Jews also have basic mitzvot called the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the Noachide mitzvot. And he writes in here, stealing is one of the 7 Noachide mitzvot. So even though this individual is not Jewish, he could be judged by a Jewish court, by a Jewish court system, because he's violating one of the mitzvot that he's expected to do under Jewish law.
Let alone copyright infringement.
Let alone copyright infringement, which is also a very big part of this discussion, but beyond the scope. He also talks about a rabbinic concept of hasagat gvul, which is where two people try to open up shop right next to each other, the same kind of business, whether we say that, I know someone's going to say the jewelers. The falafel places, the pizza places, the jeweler places. We got lots of these stories here. No shortage in every major Jewish city. You'll find these types of questions. That's called hasagat gvul, which literally means to overstep your boundary, literally. And he writes in this case that it would be a case of hasagat gvul. The other guy had the business first, and this guy stole it away from him. And then he has another point that he brings up is the point of whether we should be concerned about angering the non-Jewish populace by ruling against them. And in this case, he comes out and says we shouldn't actually have that concern. He writes here in the Hebrew, "Ein lomar demishum shalom alchudo eva nakil b'davar v'navor kava mishpat." Davar zeh einu k'demefarshim b'alei tosu shemimehem anushotim reish per. Things have changed. Our relations with the non-Jews have changed. Essentially, we don't have to be concerned for the same kind of reaction or angry reaction that might come from siding with one person over another. Kol echad yuchal itnatzel v'lomar einu tzarich liknot v'limkor. Business is a little bit more open at this time. So, one example of how this type of innovation created some challenges for the Jewish community. Another example, you brought up the question of the Sefer Torah. So there's two issues which are connected to each other. What happens if you have a, and we have it all the time, we're going to have it tonight, sheets that we studied on that were printed off of a computer, not handwritten. These ones don't have God's name on them, so that may lessen the status of their kiddusha, of their sanctity. But any type of printed paper that has on it Hebrew writing, Hebrew letters, Torah script, let's say a Sefer Torah, does that item need to be put in Geniza, need to be put away with the appropriate type of burial that we would do for a Sefer Torah written by hand? So what he writes here is, in source 5, you have the comment of the Shulchan Aruch, Sefer Torah Shabala. Sefer Torah Shabala means it's an aged Sefer Torah, it's no longer usable. Manichin oto b'kli cheres, it has to be put inside an earthenware case, something like that. And then it has to be buried appropriately. It has to be taken care of with the utmost respect. That's a Sefer Torah. What about Svarim? What about Sidurim that are torn and used from the shul and they have to, you know, remove them from the shul? Where do they go? Those are printed on paper. Those aren't printed. Those aren't handwritten. He was talking about a handwritten Sefer Torah. So the Magen Avraham in source number 6, he writes, "V'hu adin Svarim v'asul l'sorfan." He says the same would be true by printed books, and we're not allowed to burn them. And the same would be true by all items that are used in the service in a shul. So the parochet, or the gartel that ties the Sefer Torah, or the mantle that goes on top of the Sefer Torah, all these kinds of things are things that have to go in to be buried properly in Geniza. And he even says, so he even goes so far as to say that the prohibition of erasing Hashem's name, erasing God's name, applies to printed names of Hashem as well. There's one more issue that comes up with the printed, which is, can you read from such a Torah on Shabbat? Let's say it was obviously a lot more inexpensive to print using the printing press. That was one of the main motivations for this type of technology. We were going to, number one, give people access to read, teach people, educate people, which was an amazing aspect of the, probably the main feature of what the printing press brought about in the world. But there was a second piece, which was the cost of parchment, the cost of hiring a scribe and getting someone to hand write all of these things was astronomical, and very few people owned personal libraries or personal books at that time in history. So we're talking here about an opportunity to mass produce Sefer Torah, to mass produce Torah scrolls, and we can send them all around the world, and every shul can have as many as they want. The cost of paper, not even close to the, or maybe you have to do it on the hide, but even the hide is, let's say it's expensive, the cost of the scribe and the amount of time that it takes, you would finish a Sefer Torah, one per day. You can imagine. So, let's look at source number 7. Happens to be, starting with source number 6. So one of the rules of a Sefer Torah has to be written with a quill with ink. That's what's how the Shulchan Aruch writes about in the 16th century in the Code of Jewish Law in Yoredeya. In the later commentaries, so now we're jumping ahead to the 19th century, people were debating this issue. For hundreds of years, they were debating this issue of the printing press and how it impacts Jewish practice. So when he writes about the reed quill, he quotes opinions on both sides of the, like any good Jewish discussion, we got opinions on both sides of the coin. There were those who said that the printing press process is basically the same. And he actually goes through, not here, but one of the commentators that he quotes, the Taz, he goes through how the printing press is very similar to, in its process, to how a Sefer Torah is written. And what he says, I'll just go through the steps for you, it's not here in source 7, but he talks about the letters. The letters were molded in reverse. That was how they were set up in this piece of material that they went on to. There were metal stocks, there were wood stocks, and then they were put together to form words. The next step was they have a page of words put together and locked into the tablet. Then the letters were inked. That was the next step. After the letters were inked, there is a lever. You can actually see it in the picture. You can see the lever that they used to press down, and when that lever, sorry, pull, when the lever is pulled, it would turn this crank, and again, it's all kind of imagining how it would go, and that in turn would press the letters onto the paper. And when you would release the lever, the form would come back up, and the letters would be formed on the page. So the Taz, who's a commentator in the Shulchan Aruch, he says, that's the same as writing, as what a sofer is doing on a Sefer Torah. And in fact, there were many commentaries who agreed with him. Probably, it's understood, that was actually the majority opinion, which is fascinating. It's not what we follow in our shuls. It's not the practice that we follow. But if you count up the number of commentaries who thought that it made a lot of sense, that this could work, that was the majority. The problem is that those printing presses were done by hand. It was manually operated. The machines today are all automated. There's very little human input. We're going to come back to that point in a moment when we talk about the machine matzahs, because that is also an issue that came up in terms of the way that the matzot were being prepared and baked. So in the printing press of today, or the printing machine of today, we probably wouldn't be able to even argue that the Sefer Torah in that being made in that process would be permissible. One of the other issues that's brought up is the question of when you write Hashem's name, when you write God's name, there has to be a special kavanah. Anyone who's ever seen a sofer writing or spoken to somebody who's involved in this type of activity, they have to have a special thought in mind before they write, every time they write the name of God. So one of the questions came up is when you're pressing down on the letters, that is more removed, and you can't have the same kind of intention using the machine. There was actually a rabbi who took it one step further, and he said not only would it be permitted to create a Sefer Torah using the printing press, you could even have a non-Jew operating the machine, as long as he's employed by a Jew, because everything that he's doing is with the in mind that he's doing it on behalf of the Jewish employer.
But I'm confused.
Is it the fact that it's handwritten?
Yeah.
So I can.
So if the way that I
have a machine,
yeah,
that uses a stylus and ink, and you could have a Jew with the correct thought,
right,
operate that machine, and I can write a sefer in a day.
How is it? How is the...
The stylus moves back and forth.
By itself.
It moves,
right,
on an arm.
Well, that's part of the question, right? How much input is the person having in the production of the letters?
The original fax machine, which,
yeah,
we got in our office, had a stylus arm, and it had an inkwell,
yeah,
and the corresponding machine in Japan would have a stylus arm. And what it would do would be read the black and the white off that, and every time it read a black, I'd drop an ink in Toronto on the page. So I'd be two stylus arms going back and forth.
Okay.
I'd be reproducing exactly the same with ink, with a stylus arm, and I could put a quill pen in there as well. It doesn't have to be a stylus, okay?
Right.
So, is that kosher?
But you're not doing the actual writing.
I don't touch the arm.
Right, so that, I think that seems to be part of the issue.
Thought.
Right. One of the other questions that comes up. No, it's an interesting question. One of the other questions that comes up is when the letters are being pressed into the paper, the letters are all the letters are being formed at the same time. It's not one letter by one letter. That was also a question whether each letter has to be produced individually. Right. It's an interesting question. I think that the question of how far removed the human is from the process is one of the greatest questions that's going to come up also in the machine. So let's see if we come back to it next part of the discussion. So we have the very famous, and it really is one of the most raging debates in Jewish history to this day. I brought some more pictures for everyone here. Some of the first type of machine matzot, which don't look so different than the printing press, actually. But what's interesting about the history, the first machine matzot was, I believe, in 1838 in France. It was developed by a guy named Yitzhak Singer, French Jew, not to be confused with the American sewing machine inventor, apparently had the same name. And his device in the original device, and this is actually important for what we're about to say, it only rolled the dough. The kneading and the baking still had to be done by hand. So think about today, Manischewitz is producing 851,000 matzahs a day. A day. That's just Manischewitz. Right? Think about all the companies that are on the shelves today, competing for
shelf space,
exactly, or Seder table space, whatever you want to call it. Interesting, there's an article here from the New Yorker that I read, which called Manischewitz the tweaker. The tweaker was a term that was coined by Malcolm Gladwell, who's like a social scientist. So he has this concept called the tweaker. He talks about Steve Jobs, and he basically said that Steve Jobs didn't invent anything new. He just took something that already existed and he improved it, and he made it better. So that was Manischewitz and his son all together had over 50 patents that they made when they were developing their machine in America. So when it came out in Europe, there was a huge, huge discussion, a huge raging fight between different rabbinic leadership in different places. So let's just look at a few examples. Source number 8 and source number 9, you have two of Hasidic, from the Hasidic camp, Hasidic leaders, the Avnei Nezer. Again, this is actually later in the story. We're talking mid-1800s when these things started to make their way into different European cities. But what's important here as background is the Industrial Revolution. What happened in the Industrial Revolution is bakeries came about. One of the things that happened is after the steam engine, people stopped baking locally in their homes, or a few people to one place, and people started having these big factories where they were producing food. So if you still lived in a small town, and you're going to see, he references this in source number 8, he has the assumption, he's living in Sochashov, which is just a small town of maybe 3,000 people. He was under the assumption that every Jew in that town was baking their own matzahs. This is well into the late 1800s when he's writing this. So it's fascinating. I think it's 1895 when he writes this tshuva. So first he says, I never saw the machine. It's the first thing that he says. It's the bottom of source number 8. He says, Ki lo ra'iti ha-mashin me'olam. That's how he spells the word machine. Mem alef shin yud nun. I never saw the machine in my life. But he says, anyone who said it's not allowed, I agree with them. So it's a very strange kind of argument. He doesn't actually provide any halachic rationale for why he thinks it should be prohibited, but he doesn't think it should be allowed. And he writes there, Ki ha-mechar shagdolim shelefaneinu, all the great rabbis who came before us, they screamed about this, they yelled about this, the people that had permitted it. And he says, Yiyeh me'eza tam shiyiyeh, which is another way of saying, whatever reason it is, we're not doing this. So this comes back to what I mentioned really right at the beginning of our conversation, the debate between innovation and tradition, and how far you want to go, and how far you want to push, and what you want to let in. If you look in the second paragraph there, he talks about this point that I made before. I heard, shenifratz me'od, be'ezai arot, there are some places, she'enam ofin matzah kol bala bayit latzmo. Who could believe such a thing, that there are people that aren't actually making matzot on their own? So, it's hard to imagine that he wasn't aware that people weren't really doing these local, homemade types of baking, but if you understand where these rural, small villages were, these shtetls, whatever they were, probably not so surprising that that was the reality. And he writes, "Vera alai hamasa meod." He says, how could there be such a thing? He also believes that if you're making it on your own, you're going to be more careful. You're going to be more cautious about making sure that there's no chametz, there's no prohibition that gets involved in the process. So he doesn't like the machines. He believes in the Jewish people. They left Mitzrayim, they did all the work themselves. We have to commemorate that. It's once a year. He makes all of these comments. Look at number 9. You have the comment here of the Divrei Chaim. He's writing a little bit earlier, probably about 50 years earlier, mid-19th century. He talks about the issue that we might actually be dealing when we're talking about these machines, we might actually be dealing with chametz gamur, actual chametz, because the material that they were using, the conveyor belt, for lack of a better term, today I think they use Teflon, but once upon a time they didn't have those kinds of materials, and they were worried that some of the matzah would actually stick and not be scraped off properly from the machinery. And he says here again another interesting comment about not really providing a strong rationale, a logic, but kind of more against the tradition type of argument. He says, Re'iti tshuva goren zmanenom in source number 9, shiskimu la'asor v'tzakum me'od b'divrem, agam ki al'tzat divrem yesh la'ashiv. I could answer, I could say a lot about this. He says, Ach, die la'asor b'zeh. It's enough to just say it's not allowed. I don't need to go into it further. And he kind of just leaves it at that. And then he writes this comment about not being able to scrape it off properly. You might be getting into real chametz issues. So you have these opinions. Today, people assume that the debate about machine versus handmade is a Hasidic versus mitnagdik or litvish type of debate. But the truth of the matter is, it wasn't actually that way historically. It just became that way. It became this thing about what the Rebbe does and what the Hasidic community does, and you follow that path, and we don't ask any more questions. Go ahead.
But the matzah that we eat today has nothing to do with the matzah that was on the top of their kepis when they left
it. Yeah.
Is that not correct?
Not just that, but it gets thinner and thinner every year.
But wasn't it like a waffle? Wasn't it like a doughy?
It was probably more, yeah, it was so more like a waffle.
So if it's not the same as what they were doing, what are we arguing about?
If it's not the...
It's not identical to the
very good
matzah that was
very good, very good.
That was on the 100% when they left Mitzrayim.
You brought up one of the great arguments to push this away. 100%. That what you said is said by many. What you said is said by many. And in fact, the next argument will bring up this point as well. Rav Shlomo Kluger wrote this a letter, which was actually a compilation of letters. He sent to as many rabbis as he could get to sign on and to say, are you with me? We're going to make a big push and we're going to try to prohibit it and we're going to send it out to all the rabbis in Europe and everybody's going to listen to us. He got 10 rabbis to sign on. 10. Rav Shlomo Kluger was one of the great rabbinic minds of the time. And one of the things that he writes in his commentary is that this is an economic question. We're going to take away Parnassa. You're going to... innovation... right, is going to remove the manual labor and the possibility for people to be involved. So one of the things that they responded just along the lines of what you said is, well, you didn't say that about the printing press, right? When the printing press came out, that also removed a lot of the manual labor and you're taking away the parnassa from the scribes, from the sofrim. So it's this back and forth, not so much halachic, but what you might call tradition and trying to, where do we put the stop on how much innovation we're going to introduce? And Pesach is once a year and we have a unique opportunity and arguments of that nature. There's another point that's made, which is that the machine matzah is made by a machine and not by a human. And maybe, going back to some of the things that we discussed before, maybe that is a problem, either a halachic issue or at the very least, a tradition issue. If you look in Source 11, the Shulchan Aruch writes, "Ein lashin matzad mitzvah, v'lo ofin ota al yadei en Yehudi." We don't use a non-Jew to prepare the matzah. We don't use a person who has some kind of inability to think, intellectual capacity-wise, a katan, someone who's a minor. And then he writes in the Sif Bet, in Source 11, the Rush, who was one of the early commentaries, he himself, hayam yishtadel b'matzah mitzvah, he would go to the factories, he himself would be there, ve'omed al siyata, and he would watch everything that was going on, umezareis, he would, you know, make sure everybody was doing it the right way, almost like a mashkiach type of thing. He would even help them, show them how to shape it, show them how to do it right. There's an idea that each individual should be involved. So how much are we involved when we're just going to the store and buying it off of a shelf? So many people still have the custom today for at least the matzahs that they eat at the Seder, you know, to try to go to a factory or go to somebody who's making those matzahs on their own and to be part of it in some way or another. What's interesting about the development of the halacha. What's interesting about the development of the halacha is that the machines today, apparently, this is what I was reading, are one of the most regulated food industries in North America. The amount of restrictions and rules that they have probably means that the machine matzahs are less likely to become chametz than the hand matzahs. Human error versus, you know, machine error. So go figure how history, you know, and how things change over time and how technology gets improves and how that could change our perspective. So there are people today...
If you go into a factory today, is it for matzah, is that completely automated?
Almost completely automated. Yeah, almost completely automated. Somebody has to hit the on button. Right. Now, what's interesting is that it's become so automated that some people look at it and say, well, it knows 18 minutes, that's the issue. Can't let it be unobserved, right? If you're not looking at it, you're not mixing it for 18 minutes and beyond, then it can become chametz. So the machines are going to do that very particularly. A human is sometimes will, you know, maybe they won't mix it properly, and maybe there'll be some dough that doesn't get fully baked on the inside. Yeah, and so there are some people today who will not eat handmade matzah. It's gone kind of swinging in the other direction. So you have this debate, and it goes on and on, and that's one of that. One last thing, and then we'll wrap up. We won't have time to really go into this in depth, but I was going to mention this comment about the steam engine, which was an interesting question that came up in terms of people being allowed to ride the train on Shabbat when it was in its early years of being part of the transportation, the new form of transportation. And where would you find any halachic sources that could address a question like this, riding this train on Shabbat? So there is a Mishnah in Masechet Beitza, in source number 13 in the Gemara, that discuss not riding an animal on Shabbat. A person should not ride on an animal on Shabbat. And the Gemara in source number 14 explains that the reason why we don't ride an animal on Shabbat is because you may come to break off a branch from a tree to guide the animal, and breaking off a branch would be one of the 39 prohibited creative activities of pruning or cutting, reaping, harvesting, whatever you want to call it.
So why can't you do it the day before then?
Meaning, get on the...
Ready and then
yeah. Theoretically, right? Well, that actually, it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question. It gets into a rabbinic concept that the Talmud quotes in a number of places called Lo Plug Rabbanan. We could always come up with a case where we could make it permitted, but when the rabbis created the prohibition, it was a blanket prohibition. So yes, it's true, you could come up with a scenario where you wouldn't be running into the issue, but then Judaism just becomes a free-for-all, and everybody will pick their...
Like mock crap.
Like, okay. So if you look in the way that it's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch and in source 15, you have this, and then the Ramah, in the second line in source 15, he talks about riding on a wagon on Shabbat. He talks about riding on a wagon, and he says that even if the non-Jew is the one who's driving it, so the issue of the breaking off the branch is the issue of the person who's the driver of the vehicle, of the animal, okay? But if you're not the driver, then it's an issue of using the animal, in a sense. So,
well, this issue came up with the issue of the bus on Bathurst Street.
Okay.
Years ago, we met with TGC.
Yeah.
And we asked them if they would run the buses from Eglinton to Lawrence and stop at every stop and open the doors.
To allow people to just get on and get off.
So you wouldn't cause the bus to stop.
Subway's okay.
That's right.
Right.
Subway's okay.
Right.
Because you didn't cause the subway to stop at that station.
Right.
But most people don't ride the subway in Shabbat.
Okay. So you're bringing up the debate. This is the debate. So all these topics are connected in different ways. The bus one is a little bit more... has a little bit more of an understanding, especially if we're talking about a person needing to get to shul, for example. In the case that was discussed by the Chatam Sofer, and this is again right after, right around the time that the trains are starting to run in Europe, he was asked about a doctor who wanted to was asked to deliver a baby, and he had to ride the train to be able to do the delivery. So you may be dealing with issues of life and death. There's a lot of things that you can think about that might come into play to answer this kind of question. So one of the things that he gets into here, I put a few of the questions here that he discusses. Would riding a train be categorized under the prohibition to ride an animal on Shabbat? So he felt, and just fascinating how the halachic mind and process works. If you're sitting on the train, you're not the conductor. You're not sitting in the conductor's seat. So this whole issue of you might break a branch. Obviously, it's not the same application because it's not an animal and you're in an enclosed space. Would not apply because you're not sitting in the conductor's seat. So that issue he puts on the wayside. Another issue that he discusses, the issue of Tichum Shabbat. Tichum is the outer limits of a city. So when you hit the edge of a city, Toronto, you'd have to really walk very far to get to the edge of the city. Once you hit the edge of the city, you have 2,000 cubits, 2,000 amot more that you're allowed to travel, and that is your limit on Shabbat. The reason for this rabbinic Torah prohibition, it's a debate where it falls under, is because we want people to stay in their places on Shabbat. People shouldn't be traveling, you know, around and going too far away from their location of rest, where they start their Shabbat. So that's the idea of the tchum, it's the limit. So the question becomes, if you're on a vehicle that's in motion, is there a tchum, a vertical tchum? So I understand a horizontal tchum. Is there a tchum that if you go above a certain height, somehow, in a plane, in a train, in a car, would there be a way to circumvent the issue of tchum? So he discusses that question as well. His conclusion is he doesn't like the idea of riding a train on Shabbat. So he would probably not like he's not the only one who weighs in on this. He's one of the only people who weighs in on this at this time. There are a lot more modern post-scheme who've discussed the issue of the buses and shuttles in some of these retirement communities and in places where the shuttle is running 24/7 and it's picking up and dropping people off without payment, without asking people where they're going. It's just going and stopping. And he comes out against it. Not because of the riding on the animal, not because of the Tchum Shabbat. He comes out against it because of something that's called Shabbaton. The nature of what the environment of Shabbat is supposed to be about. It's not, I know some people would call it today, it's not Shabbistic. But it's more than that. It's actually a pasuk from the Torah. The Ramban writes about this. He says, theoretically, a person could run their whole business on Shabbos and not violate any commandments. Theoretically, you could have your store open, not actually do any forbidden activities, and you wouldn't have violated any Torah commandments. But what you wouldn't have done is you wouldn't have had Shabbos. You would have basically eliminated the whole concept of what Shabbat is supposed to look like. And it's supposed to be a different day than the rest of the week. In halacha call it uvda dechol. Uvda dechol basically means like a weekday activities. Which are things that we try to change up in our day to day. Go ahead.
I'm laughing because that's what they say about some of Trump's negative decisions, that they were always made on Shabbat when he couldn't get hold of his son-in-law and daughter.
By the way, this Chatam Sofer was discussed in the recent question about Jared and Ivanka coming home from the party. This Chatam Sofer was brought into the discussion. So it just goes to show how these things come relevant. I put on here just a list of some fun topics that have been thought about and have been discussed aren't realities yet, but probably will be realities. Like, I didn't even put it on here, but self-driving cars would be another interesting question, right? A self-driving car. On here I have, if one can control home appliances with the mind, would this constitute prohibited activity on Shabbat? Can you answer a blessing or kaddish via distance technology? If you walk by a TV, this is pretty much anywhere you walk on Shabbat, there's a camera that's recording you somewhere. Without even your knowledge, is that called a potential violation of writing because it's making a recording of your image on the screen.
Do I have to cross the street to avoid turning on the lights of the house that I watched?
Right. That one, similar. So right. It's related to that question. Can you fulfill Mishloach Manot by sending an email? Right. Can we ask forgiveness before Yom Kippur? Is there a text message? These are just a few. I end with a story. Listen to the story. It's a beautiful story. And we'll conclude with this. Story about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Every day for decades, a postal sack full of letters was delivered to 770 Eastern Parkway. Intimate questions typically sketch these pages. A writer looking for advice or for a blessing, for explanation or validation. The Rebbe read everything, every letter personally. An employee in Chabad's publishing division recounts, I saw firsthand the many hours the Rebbe would spend opening, reading, and responding to people's letters. So I ordered an electronic envelope opener. I figured that it would expedite the process. The next day was returned by Rabbi Groner, one of the Rebbe's secretaries. I demonstrated it and the Rebbe said it made too much noise. Rabbi Groner explained, after some research, a silent electric opener was found and submitted to the Rebbe. The following day it was returned again. Rabbi Groner said the Rebbe smiled widely at the effort, but said there was another reason for not accepting the gift. Many people seal their letters with tears, the Rebbe shared. These cannot be opened with a machine. It's a beautiful story. I think that it brings together all of the things that we've been thinking about. And obviously we appreciate the opportunity to have progress.
So what about the very first one?
Yeah.